I'm Christopher Lydon with the journalist Stephen Kinzer, who's ready to rewire America's big links in the Middle East. What if Turkey and Iran, of all nations, are our critical partners in the region, not Israel and Saudi Arabia? And how dare an ex-New York Times reporter try to shape history after writing so much of it? This is Open Source from the Watson Institute at Brown University, an American conversation with global attitude, we call it. Steve Kinzer, old friend, you are ahead of the game again. The ink is barely dry on this new book of yours titled Reset, elevating Turkey and Iran as the constructive players in the emerging Middle East. The ink is barely dry, I say, when the leaders of Turkey and Brazil show up in Iran to broker a way out of a nuclear proliferation crisis. And the established powers, including Hillary Clinton and Tom Friedman in the New York Times, say it's a perfectly horrible development. Obviously, there's a moment to savor here, but a collision for you to deconstruct. What is going on?
You're right that when I wrote this book about how Iran, Turkey, and the United States might fit together in the 21st century, I had a sense that it might be timely, but I had no idea it would be as timely as it is coming out just this week when so much is happening. Behind the confrontation and the angry words that we're seeing that are flying between Washington and some of our other capitals in the Middle East, particularly Ankara and Turkey, I think there lies a bigger issue. It's not just the question of whether the deal that Turkey and Brazil were able to strike with Iran was a good deal or a bad deal, and what exactly should be the relationship between Turkey and the U.S. There's a bigger question at work, and I think it's this. The Turks are essentially saying to the United States, the Cold War is over. You're not the undisputed king of the hill anymore, and your word is no longer law in the Middle East. Nonetheless, we're on your side, and we'd like to help you if you can adopt a less confrontational and more cooperative attitude. The Americans' reaction is, we're not there yet. We are not accepting that we have lost power in the Middle East and that we need to listen to what Turkey suggests that we do. We still feel we know best. So there's a rising group of countries in the world, in this case, represented by Turkey. And then there's the old establishment led by the United States. The new emerging group says there's a power vacuum and we want to help fill it. The Americans are saying, no, there is no power vacuum. We still insist on being the boss. That's what underlies this clash.
No question. Something like this had to happen in the sense of regional powers. Some people call them the BRICSA nations, Brazil, India, China, South Africa sometimes, name your players, but the second tier wants to say, Uncle Sam, you haven't given us a perfect world, but there are other players here who might get in on the game. Suddenly, it's this extremely sensitive issue around Iran, and you somehow anticipated it. That, to me, is the fascinating scoop to begin with.
Turkey and Iran have always been countries that fascinated me in that part of the world. In fact, they're really the only two countries in that part of the world that I find really engaging.
Well, lay it out. You've also been the New York Times correspondent in Tehran and in Istanbul, which gives you a start.
One of the things that I try to lay out in my book is that Turkey and Iran are unique in the Muslim Middle East because of their long history of working toward democracy. I devote about the first half of the book to taking the reader through these fantastic stories.
Working and failing, Steve, let's be real.
It's true. The 100-year march of Iran and Turkey toward democracy has been full of setbacks as well as advances. Nonetheless, this is a march that has been underway now for several generations. During that period, Turks and Iranians have assimilated certain ideas of Enlightenment-style democracy. They know what is a parliament, what is a political campaign, what is a political candidate. They understand political parties. They realize that you're not supposed to vote for the party that represents your religion or your region or your race, but the party that represents your political point of view. It takes generations for these ideas to take hold in any country. And they can't take hold when they're imposed by a foreign army at the point of a gun. But Turkey and Iran are two countries that decided on their own a long time ago that they wanted to have Western-style democracy. They've had setbacks, as we said, and certainly Iran is quite far from that now. Nonetheless, Turkey is certainly the most democratic Muslim society in the Middle East, and Iran, I think, actually has the potential, under the right circumstances, to become even more democratic than Turkey. It doesn't have some of the barriers to democratization that Turkey is now running up against. And if somehow the veneer of this repressive religious regime could be peeled back, I think you'd see a very, very vibrant democracy emerging in Iran. Most people in the world were quite shocked, and I was one of them, by the repression with which the regime suppressed those post-election protests in Iran a year ago. Nonetheless, to me, the bigger story was the protests themselves. You would not see post-election protests in, let's say, Egypt, because everybody expects the elections to be stolen in Egypt. And there wouldn't be post-election protests in our ally like Saudi Arabia, because there are no national elections. But in Iran, people insist that their votes count. And when they have problems with their democracy, they go out and protest. So to me, the intensity of the reaction to this apparently stolen vote is a great indication of how democratic Iranian society still is.
We got to talk about each of these four countries in a way. Turkey and Iran, you say, are the hope. But then Israel and Saudi Arabia, which you say have become, in effect, the sort of barnacled problem. But start with Turkey and Iran. Turkey is also the mother of ethnic cleansing. I mean, ask the Greeks, ask the Armenians, ask the Albanians. They have an ugly history. And as somebody says in your book, they have given themselves a historical lobotomy and deny everything. I mean, there's an erotic problem there. Iran seems to glory in being a kind of pariah nation with its repression, with its Holocaust denial, which just plain provokes the world and they love it. Make the case that there's something close to being constructively good in both of those places.
Turkey is a country that really offers, I think, a remarkable opportunity for the United States. Turkey is a vibrant Western-style capitalist democracy. It's a big country. It's very successful economically. It's attracting huge amounts of investment from all over the region, and its companies are working all over the former Soviet Union, and Asia, and Africa, and beyond. Turkey is now looking to play a very interesting role in the world, particularly in its local region as a conciliator and a maker of deals. Now, you're talking about Turkey's history and Iran's sort of odd behavior. You're quite right in both cases. Nonetheless, the situations look a little differently when you're on the ground there. Turkey is actually the country that is responsible for the negotiated population exchange with Greece in the 1920s, when many hundreds of thousands of Muslims came from Greece back to Turkey, and more than a million Greeks went in the other direction. The Ottoman Turks were also those responsible for the massacres of Armenians in 1915. Nonetheless, when you're in Turkey, one thing you become very aware of is that Turkey is a country that is made up of people whose ancestors were the victims of ethnic cleansing. Anytime you talk to somebody in Turkey and ask them about their background, pretty soon, within 1 minute, you're going to hear, well, great-grandpa came from Bulgaria, came from Bosnia, came from the Caucasus, came from some other place that used to be in the Ottoman Empire, but it fell. And then my grandparents were chased from their houses, and they had to walk across from Bulgaria under persecution. Then these Turks build their own nation against all odds, and now wake up to say here that they are being accused of being ethnic cleansers, which, of course, is not an empty accusation. Well, nonetheless, from their point of view, things look a little different.
History is complicated. The Ottomans had a far-flung, very tolerant, decentralized empire in many respects. And yet, this is a country that today, 21st century, wants to put Orhan Pamuk, their Nobel novelist, on trial for saying, we killed a million Armenians.
Well, that's true, Chris, but let's make clear who this country is. The regime, the government in power, is bitterly against this prosecution. And the people that want to prosecute Orhan Pamuk are the very same people who want to bring down this government. Here's what their calculus is. How can we make the United States and Europe push Turkey away. We don't want to be swallowed up by Europe. That's going to mess up all of our nice economic games that we're playing here and our traditional political system. So maybe if we try to prosecute the most famous Turk in the world, people won't like our regime. It's all carefully planned out to give Turkey a bad image, and it's succeeding.
Iran simply poses a kind of Nixon to China riddle. How do you see through to the deeper reality? Nixon went to China when Chinese weapons were killing Americans in Vietnam. Make the case for the bold stab at a different future.
It's not realistic to expect that Iran would negotiate a serious compromise with the United States and the West simply on the nuclear issue. It seems to me that that's the highest card in Iran's political hand right now. It might be possible to expect Iran to make some kind of a security compromise in a broader context. That is, if all the other issues are on the table, and if Iran had more to offer, they could also not only offer to compromise on their nuclear program, but reduce their support for militant groups in the Middle East, perhaps even encourage them to change their attitudes. In exchange, the U.S. could lift sanctions and promote trade and do other things that Iran wants. Then, in that context, I think the nuclear issue might be negotiable. But until that happens, until the United States is willing to open up the agenda, which is exactly what Nixon did when he went to China with the Shanghai communique, then I don't see what's in it for Iran. The sanctions option that the U.S. is now pursuing at the United Nations is not likely to produce any result. I'm not necessarily against sanctions in principle or morally. I'm just trying to figure out what's the end game. So what do we hope to achieve? Do we think that this is going to make Iran fall down on its knees and surrender? If we think that, maybe it's worth doing, but I don't think that's realistic. I do think that President Ahmadinejad is acutely aware of how unpopular he is, and realizes that the one thing that could make him very popular, not only in Iran, but throughout the entire Muslim world, would be somehow to provoke an attack by Israel or the United States. And part of his calculus is, what can I say that would be the most outrageous to make someone want to attack me so that I can then become the martyr and go down in history as the new Saladin? So I put some of his comments about the Holocaust in that category. Now, is this the right moment to approach the regime of Iran with some kind of negotiating offer after it has just so brutally crushed this democratic uprising following last year's election? I guess not, but there isn't going to be an ideal moment to engage this regime. I've just come back from Iran, and one of the things that was very clear to me there is that the steam has fallen out of the protest movement. The regime is in power, at least for the medium term. If that's the case, then that presents the United States with kind of an intriguing dilemma. So what do we do now? If we're not going to talk, that means we're going to be out of touch with Iran for some years to come. Now, if the democratic movement in Iran were to tell the United States and the West, don't negotiate with these people, we want to isolate them, then I think we would have to pay attention to that. But in the meantime, the green movement in Iran has no good options. The best of its bad options would be for the regime somehow to be drawn out of its isolation and its paranoia, and some kind of international engagement might be a way to do that.
Steve Kinzer, the equally bold leap in your book is to let a new relationship with Turkey and Iran displace, change radically our historic, certainly since World War II, relations with Saudi Arabia and Israel. Explain that one.
I guess my book might stir up a little bit of a cold broth from the bottom of the barrel there. I don't put it quite that graphically, but I do talk about, since I'm talking about the new relationship I'd like to see the U.S. develop in the Middle East, the old relationships as well. So more or less for most of the Cold War, let's say for the last several decades at least, the United States has shaped its approach to the Middle East principally along the lines of the perceived interests, anyway, of Saudi Arabia and Israel. Essentially, in Washington, the rule has generally been what Saudi Arabia wants, Saudi Arabia gets. What Israel wants, Israel gets. Now, it's been traditional to believe that our relationship with Saudi Arabia is mainly based on our need for oil, and our relationship with Israel is based on shared values or ideals. There's some truth to those cliches, but the real basis of that relationship goes deeper. During the Cold War, those two countries cooperated with us in very special ways. Saudi Arabia and Israel were the countries that gave us help that none of our other Cold War partners could give us. Hmm. They gave us covert aid or semi-clandestine aid in many countries that we wanted to help, but for various political reasons could not help. When we wanted to aid the army in Guatemala, for example, in the 1980s, but Congress wouldn't let us because the army was too brutal, President Reagan arranged for Israel to start supplying Guatemala.
This, to me, was really the shocking news of your book, how much dirty work Israel had done and how much Saudi Arabia had paid for, especially in Latin America, but not only, during the Cold War.
During the Cold War, we had many countries that supported us in public, in the United Nations, and in our various policy positions, but there were only two countries, Israel and Saudi Arabia, that were willing to go further with us. Whatever we needed, when we needed to set up an exile army to go fight Gaddafi, or we suddenly needed troops to protect Mobutu in Zaire, or we needed money for the Contras, or we needed money for the Mujahideen in Afghanistan, we knew that Israel and Saudi Arabia would help us, even if that help was on the margins of our laws and their laws and international law. That gave us a special tie to them that wasn't really clear at the time. That was a fundamental reason why the U.S. remained so close to Israel and so close to Saudi Arabia during the Cold War. Now, that period is over, and that uniquely valuable help that those countries were able to give us is not something that we require anymore. In the new century, relations need to change when strategic environments change. And that certainly has happened in the Middle East. The U.S. has many new strategic opportunities there, also new strategic challenges. So both of our traditional relationships, the one with Israel and the one with Saudi Arabia, need to be reexamined so we can figure out how they best fit our needs and the needs for regional security in the 21st century.
Who's going to let you do that? For President Obama or any American politician to even nominate that notion in the Congress would be, it would be either laughed down or shut down before you could say boo, no?
First of all, I do think that one of the roles of writers and thinkers is try to propose some ideas that might not be able to get through Congress next week. On the other hand, I would say this. I feel that there's a growing sense in Washington that because of the hothouse environment of domestic Israeli politics, Israel is taking steps that endanger its own long-term security. For me, the greatest long-term guarantee for Israel is a stable neighborhood. If the Middle East is calm over the long run, that's the best guarantee for Israel. Therefore, it should be in Israel's interests and the interests of the United States to do whatever possible to calm the region. A policy that pursues that is actually the one that protects Israel best in the long run, even if some modern-day leaders of Israel might argue differently.
So two things develop as your book comes to press. One, President Lula of Brazil and Prime Minister Erdogan from Turkey actually show up in Tehran. What did you think?
Actually, I think both of those leaders believed that they were on a mission that had been more or less endorsed by the United States. We're not really sure whether they overinterpreted this or what happened exactly, but they felt that they were lessening a dangerously escalating confrontation and giving both sides a way out. The reaction from Washington was vituperative. The Brazil-Turkey deal struck with Iran was immediately rejected. It was not even looked at as maybe the interesting basis, although quite insufficient for some future arrangement. Instead, it was totally rejected, and the leaders of Brazil and Turkey were ridiculed, essentially, in Washington as innocent, naive schoolboys who'd been snookered by these crafty Iranians.
The deal being to offload some of that uranium to Turkey, get it out of the way, which didn't seem to satisfy people, but the underlying impetus, as you say, to sort of share the load of world peacemaking with Uncle Sam. Which was the problem?
I think very much the latter was the problem. The deal that was struck with Iran did have some holes in it. There was a lot of uranium that wasn't accounted for. Nonetheless, if the U.S. had wanted to make a deal with Iran, maybe would have grabbed on this as a bridge to some more substantial accord. The bigger problem is that we would seem to be subcontracting our foreign policy out to another group of countries. We would be seeming to say, you know, perhaps we don't know the right way to approach Iran and defuse this conflict. Maybe Brazil and Turkey know better. We are not yet at the point of being able to say that.
In the meantime, the way the rest of us read policy through Tom Friedman in the New York Times, it was outrage. As ugly as it gets, he said, the whole notion of Brazil, for all its faults, and Turkey pandering to these repressive, evil people in Tehran, he thought, discredited the whole notion. You read Tom Friedman critically, as I do. Make sense of that. What's he up to?
I think there's still a residue of anger at Turkey for its refusal to allow American troops to invade Iraq in 2003. That might be the beginning of this whole process. There's still some people in Washington that are angry at Turkey for not doing that. And in fact, at one point, Turkey was even being blamed by senior Bush administration officials for helping to cause the crisis in Iraq because they didn't allow us to launch that kind of invasion. I also think there's a mindset that tells people in Washington, when we decide something, the NATO allies and everybody else that considers themselves our friends has to go along. The idea that another group of countries in the world is going to suggest we live here, we know this neighborhood, and we have a different idea is something the U.S. is still very uncomfortable with. There is a real mindset in Washington that we need to hold on to the kind of power that we're used to having. And this, to me, is one of the biggest problems that my book and others are trying to address. It's not just what should be our new relationships in the Middle East, and that's, of course, something I try to give some opinion about in my book, but there's a bigger question, and that is, how do we break American foreign policy out of this very narrow spectrum of acceptable opinions? There is such an inertia in the foreign policy-making process that any original thinking is crushed immediately as the germ of some terrible plague that might somehow infect the entire foreign policy making process if it's not immediately stopped. So, although I like to think I've come up with an interesting approach to the Middle East, I can understand that some people might see flaws in it or have a different approach. But what I really would like to get across as a bigger message is, let's think big. Let's come up with some new ideas. The century changed. The Cold War is over. But our policies, particularly in the Middle East, have not changed. So if you don't like the way I'm proposing it, come up with some other big alternative. But keeping yourself stuck in the same rut is going to intensify these interlocking crises in the Middle East that are producing such growing threats for the West.
In the meantime, not just a new century, but the unipolar hyperpower moment is probably past too. And the world is waiting. We're all waiting for some adjustment, some new conversations, some more people at the table.
And there's another interesting aspect to this. Don't forget that Turkey, at the beginning of the Erdogan government in 2003, around that period, was still very intensely working on the project of getting into the European Union. That was a campaign that helped carry Erdogan into power. He came in with the promise, I'm going to focus on getting us into the EU. Our previous so-called secular governments never did that. They said they wanted to get Turkey in, but they didn't do the work. They didn't make the reforms. Turkey did make a number of reforms, not as much as Europe would have liked. Nonetheless, some prominent Turkish leaders, particularly Merkel and Sarkozy, and the Austrians also have quite clearly slammed the door in Turkey's face. None of this might be happening now had that process gone differently. Turkey was essentially told by Europe, we don't want you. So Turkey, as an ambitious rising power in the region, decided, well, Europe is not our future, at least not in the foreseeable years. So where else are we going to play out our policy ambitions? And that is part of this whole process you're now seeing unfolding.
Turkey's looking east. Meantime, another important little straw in the wind, it's under a Turkish flag that this humanitarian mission sails toward Gaza and is savaged by the Israeli Defense Force. I mean, people worry about that dimension, too, of a shift coming between Israel and its one-time only or best friend in the Muslim world, Turkey.
Naturally, with a number of Turkish civilians now having been killed by the Israeli Defense Force, there's an intense emotional outcry in Turkey. And the idea that we should calm down and think about what's really good for us in the long run and forget our emotions is a hard one to sell in Turkey, just as it is here. Nonetheless, despite all the emotion that's raging in Turkey, I don't think it's a good idea for Turkey to break off its long and very productive relationship with Israel. Israel and Iran, in one sense, are comparable countries, and that is, they're the two countries in the Middle East that a lot of their neighbors don't like, and a lot of other countries in the world don't like. There's a great impulse to want to lash out at these countries and punish them and sanction them and show them how unhappy we are with them. This is unwise. It's just reacting to emotion. These are two powerful countries. There's not going to be peace in the Middle East without them. None of the principal goals that the U.S. wants in the Middle East, whether it's a nuclear-free Middle East or a safe Iraq or a calm Lebanon or an end to the Israel-Palestine crisis, can be reached without Israel and Iran. There's no point in isolating them and pushing them into corners and making them feel alone and friendless and angry. The only wise solution in the long run is to try to find ways to entice them back in so that some kind of regional security architecture for that region can be established in which they would both feel safe. The world needs Iran to make a big security concession. The world also needs Israel to make security concessions. But countries only make security concessions when they feel safe. Therefore, it should be in the interests of the West and the United States to do what's necessary not only to make Israel feel safe, but to make Iran feel safe as well.
Steve Kinzer, look ahead, 6 months or a year. The Obama administration coming toward the end of a first term, approaching election, but looking for ways to be itself, to find new ways. Which of these headlines today is still going to feel urgent?
We may allow the events of these last few weeks to fade into the past. Nonetheless, I think there are some fundamental questions that will still remain. One is going to be, what is our relationship with Turkey? Are we going to have a partnership relationship, which would require us to listen a little more to Turkey? Or are we going to feel that Turkey is kind of a lost cause and let it drift away, which I think would be very unfortunate? Another bigger question is, what's going to be our relationship with Iran? There's every indication that this crisis is going to continue to escalate. The sanctions that are being proposed in the United Nations are certainly not going to have the effect that the Americans want. When that becomes clear, then what's the next step? I think that question is still very open. I also fear that there's a political calculus in Washington as well. I could imagine people telling President Obama, or President Obama telling himself, even several decades after Vietnam, the United States, and particularly a president from the Democratic Party, cannot be seen as trying to make a compromise with some evil dictator who's denying the Holocaust and repressing protesters. That's just not going to look right for somebody or a party that has already been stigmatized as being too ready to cooperate with America's enemies. So the idea that we would put aside these electoral and political considerations and put aside our emotions and think coolly about what should be American policy in the Middle East for the 21st century is pretty far-fetched, I agree. Trying to come up with a whole new approach to the world's most volatile region is the kind of grand project that the American political system does not handle very well.
It was the end of his first term, though, that Nixon did make that move to China. It didn't require the second term.
Well, with Nixon, of course, he had this other asset, which is that he was already seen as a hardliner. Obama doesn't have that. There are some straws in the wind suggesting that perhaps there might be some initiative if there's a second Obama term. Nonetheless, the crisis in Iran is not stagnant. The centrifuges are continuing to spin. It's not getting to the urgent point quite yet, but at some point, some decisions are going to have to be made. And the key one is, which is worse? allowing Iran to become a nuclear power or intervening militarily to try to prevent that from happening.
How does the world feel, Steve Kinzer, about Turkey's ambitions in the East? Prime Minister Erdogan made a mark with Shimon Peres after the Gaza massacres, strongly critical, and people felt a rumble there, not only that he was rebuking Israel, but courting a new role in the Arab Middle East. You have a picture in your book of a modern Turkey almost resuming the range of a sphere of influence very similar to the old Ottoman Empire. Should we welcome this?
There are going to be new powers rising in the Middle East. Who are they going to be? The best powers that would be logical partners for us and powers that we would like to see rise should be powers that have two qualifications. On the one hand, they should be countries whose long-term strategic goals are somewhat comparable to ours, certainly not in conflict with ours. And then there's a second thing. It's not good enough just to have relations from one regime to another or between two ruling groups. The societies of the two countries have to have something in common for these relationships to be productive. Now, if a new country is going to emerge that will be able to project its influence and the force of its example in the Middle East, there's no better choice than Turkey. Turkey is a functioning democracy. It has a thriving capitalist economy. It's a member of NATO. You're not going to get any country with those assets that is going to emerge to try to influence the Middle East. That kind of influence will be much more healthy in the Middle East than influence emerging out of Egypt, influence emerging out of Saudi Arabia, influence emerging out of any other country in that region. When you go through the list, the one country whose values you would like to see duplicated in the rest of the Muslim Middle East is Turkey.
I'm fascinated, too, by Steve Kinzer's role in all this, and a writer sort of breaking the bonds of mere reporting to launch as provocative an idea as this. What's the Steve Kinzer story here?
As you said, I worked for the New York Times for many years, and I had really a front row seat to history. I had three big foreign postings, and in each of those, looking back on it, I can see I had a chance to witness a big historical moment. I was posted in Central America in the 1980s. That turned out to be the last gasp of Marxist people's revolution in the Third World. In the early 90s, I was posted in Germany, where I got to watch the emergence of a whole new post-communist Europe, the unification of Germany, wars in former Yugoslavia. And then finally, I was sent off to Turkey, where I got to watch the emergence of a whole new region, not just Turkey, but also these new countries that emerged out of the former Soviet Union that had never even existed within a few years before I started covering them. So all of those were fascinating, but there does come a time after a period when you begin to ask yourself, so what does it all mean? When you're a newspaper reporter, naturally you're writing about things that just happened today or this week. But I was always interested in things that happened 100 years ago and also things that might happen 100 years from now. As the Iraq War happened, I began to realize that I'd like maybe to have the freedom to make my own comments on countries that I covered and countries about which I know something. And there were a series of other reasons that led me to leave the New York Times. And in this sense, it is liberating because to take such a definitive position or to recommend such clear policy alternatives and to break out of the narrow spectrum of acceptable policy options that the foreign policy establishment certifies as approved is something that's much easier to do when you're not employed full-time by the newspaper of record.
It's an exciting, liberating thing to watch, Steve Kinzer. I was always sorry that the Times didn't post you to the war in Iraq. You might have raised questions that didn't get raised.
Maybe that was the reason.
Well, I thought so. But it's a wonderful world in which your voice can be heard as clearly as this. What's the life cycle of an idea like this, Steve? And what's the force behind it, do you suppose? And there are two parts to that question. One, I mean, where does it go from here? But also, I'd like you to reveal a little bit of the friends and sympathizers, as well as the blurbers of your book, who are rooting for this kind of idea. I mean, I noticed Juan Cole of the famous blog, Gary Sick at Columbia, probably the senior American academic authority on Iran, but others, Flint Everett in the policy game, in the journalistic game, who are clearly encouraging this idea. What gives an idea like this force?
Well, I'd say two things. First of all, about the durability of this idea. Because of what just happened with Iran in the last few days and what just happened in Turkey in the last few days, these ideas that I'm putting forward in this book, Reset, are naturally very topical. Some people would say they become less viable because of what just happened. But actually, this is a long-term idea. When I say Iran, for example, makes a good partner for the United States, and you want to argue, but the Iran regime is not friendly to the U.S., that doesn't contradict my argument. I don't disagree with that. I'm talking about the long run. Over the 21st century, how would you like to see American relations develop as regimes come and go in the Middle East and governments come and go in the United States? Now, as for the people that have endorsed my book, you're right, it's a very interesting group, and I got some interesting feedback from them, particularly from people who you mentioned that are very much in the foreign policy establishment. I wrote an email to one of them saying, I know that some of the ideas in this book might be a little bit provocative, and you're meeting with people and having lunch with people every day that might be offended by some things in this book. So I'm very grateful to you for agreeing to go out on a limb and endorse it. And he sent me back a note saying, let me tell you, a lot of us people here in Washington would like to be able to say these things. We're very frustrated with the way the policy is so stuck. But the best we can do is to endorse other people who say the things that we'd like to say.
Steve Kinzer, if the principles you lay down in this book, Reset, were really acceptable to American policymakers in the age of Obama, wouldn't we be doing something quite different in Afghanistan and Pakistan? In other words, we would be engaging the regional powers, including Iran and India and Russia and China, more explicitly. We would be conceding that after Iraq and Vietnam in our recent history, there's a less unilateral, less military, more regional, more cooperative way to do business.
Certainly the idea that there could be an alternative approach to Iran, which would be more regional and more negotiation-oriented, has a counterpart in Afghanistan and in Pakistan. The idea of engaging regional powers is exactly the kind of thing that Turkey would be promoting. Turkey is actually our best bridge there. When the Turkish diplomats show up in Pakistan, for example, it's remarkable how every faction is open to them. There's no other country in the world that has relations with such a broad variety of factions in Afghanistan, just like in Pakistan, in Lebanon, in so many of these different countries. Turkey has this historical credibility and now religious credibility to add to its political and economic credibility. So, it's the same impulse. Let's try a different approach to Afghanistan. Let's try a different approach to Iran. That is what Turkey is trying to sell the United States on. But in order to do either one of those things, the United States still has to make a conceptual breakthrough that it hasn't made yet. And that is to begin thinking, we're not going to be able to solve all these crises by ourselves, and maybe the way that we've come up with for resolving them isn't the best way. Maybe we ought to listen to some people in the neighborhood who have different ideas. The United States is just not at the point of that kind of reasoning yet.
How long does it take to get to a place like that?
When Henry Kissinger had his first conversation with Zhou Enlai in China as the opening to China was beginning, Kissinger turned to Zhou Enlai and asked what I think was actually a fascinating question. He said to Zhou Enlai, do you think the French Revolution was a success?
I remember.
Zhou Enlai turned to him and said, it's too early to tell. That really does show you the long-term view that China takes of the world. It also, to me, is an example of the kind of view that a big power has to take if it wants to survive a long time. The United States is still not there, but if the U.S. cannot adjust to changing times, its long-term survival is more questionable.
Steve Kinzer, people remember with anger the hostage crisis in Iran in 1979, destroyed Jimmy Carter and embittered relations ever after. What we forget, of course, is what you wrote about in a marvelous book that I never forget, All the Shah's Men. The whole incident was directly traceable to our destruction of a brilliant young democracy in Iran in 1953, which produced the Shah repression and eventually a religious revolution. How do we bring our own history in Iran, our own hand in the creation of the Ahmadinejad madness, to the fore?
The Iran story is really a fantastic example of blowback and how things that seem successful at first might actually wind up being very negative for you in the long run. When you read a history of the 20th century, you might, if you're lucky, see one line about Mohammad Mossadegh or the coup of 1953. But we now know from looking around the world of today what a huge impact that operation had. So in 1953, as you said, Iran was consolidating a young democracy. However, that democracy produced the nationalization of Iranian oil. That led the British and Americans to come in and overthrow Prime Minister Mossadegh in 1953. That was not just the end of Mossadegh, but that was the end of democracy in Iran. That just took the CIA about 3 or 4 weeks to do in the summer of 1953. It was a pretty easy operation. But what happened? We put the Shah back on his peacock throne. He ruled with increasing repression for 25 years. That repression produced the explosion of the late 1970s, the Islamic Revolution that brought the crazy mullahs to power. That revolution also terrified the Soviets. It led them to invade Afghanistan. That brought the United States into its Afghan adventure. It was that revolution that also emboldened Saddam to attack Iran. That brought the United States into its death embrace with Saddam, that we're still spiraling out of. So a lot of history came from those few weeks in the summer of 1953 in Tehran. It's truly an object lesson. We Americans think that U.S.-Iran relations essentially begin and end with the hostage crisis of 1979. Iranians feel that that crisis was just a kind of a blip, and that the real moment when everything went bad was when the U.S. came in and overthrew their fledgling democracy in 1953.
Are you turning the clock back, in a sense, to 53? Let's take those Iranian democratic impulses and move forward in a new century. Is that the idea?
I would certainly say this. There are three forms of alternatives for government in Iran. There's democracy, there's a military rule, and there's religious rule. Now, the democracy ended in 1953. Then we've had a quarter of a century of military dictatorship. And we've had about 30 years of religious rule. If the cycle is going to continue, it's democracy's turn next. And actually, in my new book, Reset, I have a photo. The last picture in the book is a picture of somebody from these last protests of just last June walking in the streets with a portrait of Mossadegh, say, with a Farsi title that says, "We will not let history repeat itself." When you hold up a picture of Mossadegh in Iran, you're saying everything. That means I favor a return to secular democracy. I think the unfolding of Iranian politics is not over yet. This story is still unfolding, and we're going to get a positive result if we can only be patient and wait for it.
Steve Kinzer, it's a bold, wonderfully interesting book, Reset: Think Turkey and Iran in a New Middle East Where We're Not Exclusively Dependent or Responsive to Saudi Arabia and Israel. Congratulations. Wonderful work.
Great to hear that from you, Chris. Thanks for having me on.
Paul McCarthy and Ben Mandelkern produced and edited this conversation. It isn't over till listeners add their two bits in comments on our website, radioopensource.org. I'm Christopher Lydon. Thank you for being part of the conversation.